from the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. And we have one case set at 3 o'clock for oral submission. I understand everybody's here and ready to go, so we'll call the case.
The court will now call Lady Whitmore and Lady Whitmore versus National Credit Union Association. May it please the court, this is Lane W. Walker, who offers for the appellant. This is Lane W. Morris, Jr., who offers for the appellant.
All right.
May I please the court? Counsel. Today we're asking this court to reverse the trial court's judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, and the award of attorney's fees in favor of the NCHA, as well as to render judgment on Lanny Whitmire's claim for attorney's fees. My name is Jim Walker, and today I have the distinct privilege of representing Ray and Lanny Whitmire in this case against the National Cutting Horse Association. The first issue that we presented for review relates to the simple fact that the trial court erred in disregarding the jury verdict and granting the NCHA judgment notwithstanding the verdict, when there was substantial evidence presented to the jury of each element of Lanny Whitmire's claims for breach of contract and false imprisonment. The existence of an agreement between the NCHA and Lanny Whitmire that her non-professional status would be reinstated at the end of her six-month suspension was established by direct testimony and by circumstantial evidence. Now, this is an issue that this court wrote upon in some detail in your prior opinion, so I will not go into great detail about the certain aspects or facts of it, but suffice to say that there was substantial evidence presented on the issue that the court expressed an interest in its prior opinion.
We remember the case well.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Mr. Brewster at trial testified that the NCHA and Lanny Whitmire agreed through their respective counsel to settle their ongoing membership dispute. The terms of the contract were simply this, that Lanny Whitmire would forego any further hearings and appeals before the NCHA committees at that time. There was such a hearing scheduled to dispose of the issue of whether or not she was eligible as a non-professional under the NCHA rules. She would accept a six-month suspension of her NCHA membership. She would be eligible to compete as a non-professional at the conclusion of her six-month suspension. And if the rules changed in the interim, and Mr. Brewster had discussed, according to his testimony, proposing such a change with Mr. Goins, she would be eligible also to compete as an amateur. The only term of the contract, as Mr. Brewster described it and testified before the jury at trial, that was disputed by the NCHA during that trial was the reinstatement of Lanny Whitmire as a non-professional after the six-month suspension. Lanny Whitmire testified that she agreed to forego her appeal and hearing based on the settlement agreement, and that the agreement allowed her to compete as a non-professional after the expiration of the agreed-upon six-month suspension. There was substantial circumstantial evidence as well to support the jury's verdict finding the existence of this contract. After the expiration of the six-month suspension, Lanny Whitmire applied as a non-professional. In response to questions contained on the form, she stated that her amateur status had been suspended and revoked by the NCHA, but that her non-professional status had merely been suspended. Statements made by Lanny Whitmire on her application were made, recall, before she knew the NCHA would breach the agreement that Clark Brewster had reached on her behalf with Mr. Goins acting as counsel for the NCHA, and further demonstrated the existence of that agreement as Mr. Brewster had negotiated and described it at trial. There was further circumstantial evidence as well. No NCHA committee, for example, ever mentioned a suspension of Lanny Whitmire's membership in any of their recommendations with respect to the hearings that had been conducted prior to that date. The only recommendation, of course, Justice Gabriel. Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that exhibit you're looking at is Mr. Goins' correspondence that does not have a signature line, and there was substantial evidence and testimony at the trial about that letter as well. Upon receiving that letter, Mr. Brewster called Mr. Goins, as he testified at trial, and said, I saw your letter. I just want to make sure that our agreement, as we negotiated and agreed upon, remains intact, and that agreement is that upon the completion of the six-month suspension, that in fact she would return as a non-pro. And Mr. Goins assured him, according to Mr. Brewster's testimony, yes, our agreement remains intact. Mr. Brewster went on to testify that with respect to the specific wording of that agreement, he was not going to argue with a senior lawyer and colleague about particular draftsmanship. Mr. Goins was not asking him to sign that as a binding contract. He had Mr. Goins' word, and he believes and operates in a world where a lawyer's word is his bond, and that was good enough for Mr. Brewster at that time. Now, further circumstantial evidence supporting the existence of the agreement was that the only recommendation pertaining to her amateur status was suspended, and with respect to the actual letter that was calling the hearing, they said that they wanted that the non-pro status would be suspended, presuming she couldn't produce evidence at the upcoming hearing to the contrary. That was the hearing that was then continued by agreement between Mr. Goins and Mr. Brewster until the January 4, 2005 date. And that was the hearing that prompted the negotiations and was extended again to allow those negotiations to consummate themselves in the agreement as Mr. Brewster testified. There was, therefore, never a hearing held to determine if she was eligible as a non-pro. Mr. Brewster, as the record reflects, had written a letter to Mr. Goins pointing out that while he needed some additional time because of the holidays and the futurity, this is the November-December area, that he actually intended to bring unqualified sworn testimony substantiating the simple fact that she had never been and was not then a professional trainer and was therefore eligible as a non-professional in the NCHA. It was that testimony and that evidence that was never presented at any hearing because the hearing was never held because of the settlement agreement between them. And in fact, the settlement agreement was reached before that hearing to determine the status of her non-professional membership. She testified, Ms. Whitmire did, that she accepted a suspension of her full membership only because it was part of a settlement agreement. Clark testified that he called her. He told her, based upon the ugly incident that had taken place in the locker room during the futurity, that constituted the factual basis for the false imprisonment claim, that it was probably best if tempers cooled, and he suggested that based upon Mr. Goins' proposal, because Mr. Brewster also testified that the settlement agreement on the terms that Mr. Brewster understood were in place, that he called Mr. Goins to confirm were in place after receiving that letter, that that settlement agreement was actually proposed by Mr. Goins in a call that he initiated to Mr. Brewster. And upon recommendation of counsel, Ms. Whitmire was submitted to the recommendation advice and accepted the settlement agreement. But that was the only reason she accepted the revocation of her membership. Now, the jury could reasonably conclude from these facts that there was an agreement to reinstate her non-professional status after 6 months because Lainey Whitmire would not have agreed to a greater punishment than had been recommended by the responsible NCHA committee. In fact, if she had gone forward with the hearing and they had ruled that she was not eligible as a non-professional, she would have retained her NCHA membership. She would have been limited to competing in the open class, but her membership was never part of any prior hearing or recommendation by any relevant committee. There was also substantial evidence to address a point that was raised in your prior opinion. There was substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict of the existence of the contract based on actual and apparent authority and ratification. Now, in this particular instance, both the definitions of actual and apparent authority and ratification were part of the court's charge to the jury. It was contained and defined there in the charge, and those were submitted to the jury as part of the court's charge without objection from the NCHA. Now, as this court said in its prior opinion, an attorney retained for litigation is presumed to possess actual authority to enter into a settlement on behalf of a client. Now, there's substantial evidence that was submitted at trial that Mr. Goins had, in fact, that actual and apparent authority to enter into the agreement as Mr. Brewster described it. Mr. Goins had acted as the NCHA's outside general counsel for many years prior to this dispute. The NCHA had held Mr. Goins out as its attorney, thereby leading the Whitmires to believe that he had in fact authority to bind the NCHA. Before the settlement was reached, the NCHA held Goins out as its counsel at the November 15, 2004 hearing, where the decision regarding the amateur status was decided but the decision regarding the non-professional status was deferred for a subsequent hearing. Mr. Goins communicated in correspondence with Mr. Brewster regarding everything from the NCHA's committee findings to an agreement to extend Laney Whitmire's deadline to provide additional information until after the January 4, 2005 hearing. Mr. Goins clearly represented the NCHA during the 2004 NCHA futurity. When Laney Whitmire was falsely imprisoned, he was in the room. He was addressing her in the presence of Don Bussey, the president at that time, Jeff Hooper, the executive director at that time, and Mr. David Bryan, the show manager, conducting and responsible for conducting the futurity. Mr. Brewster testified that it was actually Mr. Goins who proposed and negotiated the settlement with the NCHA's knowledge and prior authorization. This is all, had all been told to Mr. Brewster. The NCHA's executive director testified that Mr. Goins had authority to negotiate a settlement that had been conferred upon him by the NCHA's own executive committee, and that Mr. Goins was held out by the NCHA as its counsel for the purposes of negotiating a settlement. Also, during the authorized negotiations between Mr. Goins and Mr. Brewster, Mr. Goins confirmed that he had authority to negotiate. Nobody ever advised Mr. Brewster or Ms. Whitmire or anyone on their side of the docket, for that matter, that Mr. Goins' authority was limited in any respect. With respect to ratification, of course, it may be expressed or implied. Now, the implied ratification occurs, as you know, if a party, though he may have been unaware of the unauthorized conduct taken on his behalf at the time it occurred, retains the benefits of the transaction once it's fully disclosed to him. That's exactly the evidence that we had presented to this jury in this case. Well, it was a little bit different flavor than that. The authorization issue and the apparent authority issue, that the actual authority issue that the court identified in its opinion, was a little bit different from the way the case developed at trial, because what they were actually saying was that Mr. Goins had authority to negotiate a settlement, that Mr. Goins was in fact their lawyer responsible for negotiating the settlement, but Mr. Goins was simply saying that Mr. Brewster was lying about the terms of the settlement ultimately agreed to, and the only terms of the settlement that Mr. Goins agreed to were contained in that letter. Mr. Brewster, on the other hand, testified quite clearly that it was Mr. Goins that had the misplaced recollection, and in fact, the terms were exactly as Mr. Brewster described it, principally meaning that she would be readmitted as a non-pro upon the expiration of the six-month suspension. And Mr. Brewster also confirmed that when he got the letter, he called Mr. Goins and confirmed, "We still have our agreement, correct?" And Mr. Goins said, "Absolutely. She'll come back as a non-pro." And Mr. when all this was, when she was reapplying to be admitted, she tried to call Clark Brewster. He was not in the country. As it turns out, he was in China. And he testified that he didn't receive any of her calls until he got into a cell coverage range. And then he realized what had happened. They weren't enforcing the agreement as he'd negotiated it. So he testified that he called Jeff Hooper, the executive director, and said, "Jeff, you need to understand, this was our agreement that I negotiated with Mr. Goins. She comes back as a non-pro at the expiration of the 6 months. It was always that way. I called him. He affirmed it. There was never any doubt." He said that Mr. Hooper was described by Mr. Brewster as being in a receptive mode, that Mr. Hooper didn't dispute or argue with him. He didn't claim that Mr. Goins didn't have authority to negotiate that particular point. He simply said, "I'll get back to you." Oh, yes, ma'am. Absolutely. So,
don't shake your head. You can argue in your turn and don't smile. Keep a straight face and stop trying to communicate with the court.
So, we can see that it was fully disclosed with respect to Mr. Brewster's agreement when he called the executive director of the NCHA and conveyed it. And Mr. Hooper did not dispute anything at that time, according to Mr. Brewster, and there was never another word that was sent back to him with respect to, well, you know, he didn't have authority or anything like that. It was just that they simply refused to readmit her as a non-professional, thereby breaching the agreement as it had been reached between the parties. Now, as I recall, Mr. Goins had said that there was some trouble and time and expense with convening a hearing. And with respect to, not only was the NCHA put on full notice of the agreement, but as well, it retained the benefit of the agreement because Ms. Whitmire was deprived of the opportunity to have her hearing, to present that unqualified sworn testimony that Mr. Brewster had advised him in writing he was going to bring at that hearing to establish that under no circumstances would she be ineligible as a non-professional. She was deprived even of the opportunity to appeal an adverse ruling at that hearing. And yet they retained the full benefits of their side of the deal. Therefore, there was, in fact, legal ratification, and we believe as a result that we've met all of the burden with respect to our briefing to underscore that the trial court erred in granting a JNOV in this instance. Given the fact that I'm running out of time, I do want to address very quickly that I believe that the attorney's fees that the NCHA was awarded is also great error, because they had actually waived those fees. They had absolutely no basis whatsoever to support an award of those fees. And principally, with respect to the $300,000 plus in fees that were awarded in favor of the NCHA against Lainey Whitmire, those were awarded in connection with the declaratory judgment action that she had brought on the membership issues that formed the basis of this court's first appeal. This court affirmed the grant of summary judgment from the trial court with respect to those membership claims, and in its mandate to the trial court, there was no further mention of any action from the trial court that was required or ordered by this court. The very same final judgment entered by the trial court at that time made clear that it was a final judgment as to those claims, and at no time prior to the entry of that final judgment did they seek an award of fees or move the court for such an award. And I'm out of time. Out of respect to the court, I will... Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court, Jim Morris on behalf of National Cutting Course Association, and we are here today to urge this Court to affirm the trial court in all respects the judgments it's granted below in this case. We believe that the trial court was required by law to enter the JNOV because the evidence established as a matter of law several different items that were material elements of plaintiff's claims that had not been proven and were proven to be unsustainable. And I'm going to start with the JNOV. Actually, back up for 1 second. In addition to asking the court to affirm on all respects, we have, I would just mention, filed a conditional cross appeal in the event for any reason the court were to overrule the JNOV claims on the oral agreement. There were evidentiary errors made in terms of allowing improper expert testimony and in terms of omitting admissions by plaintiff's counsel as to the existence of the agreement and the terms of the agreement. I don't think I'm going to get to that in my argument, but I just wanted to point that out to the court. On the JNOV claim, this court has addressed that before, and it will recall that when it came up with the oral agreement issue, they found a fact issue between Don Bussey's testimony in an affidavit and Don Bussey's testimony in his deposition, and therefore found a fact question and sent it back. And the standards for authority on behalf of an attorney are prescribed in that opinion, that although there's a presumption that an authority retained for litigation may possess authority, it's a rebuttable presumption. And what the evidence showed at trial, the uncontroverted evidence showed at trial, was that that presumption was rebutted. And I think when you read this court's case the prior appeal, with some of the other authorities here, it's clear as to what the standard is. For example, these cases are all cited in our brief. In the clear case, it says where the evidence shows an attorney did not have a client's authority to agree, an agreement to settle will not be enforced.
But aren't all those just credibility issues? Wasn't it just up for the jury to decide whether or not they believe Mr. Brewster or Mr. Boyne?
Justice Walker, I don't think so in this instance, and I'll explain why. What Mr. Walker's talking about is the conflicting testimony between Goins and Brewster as to whether an agreement was ever made or not. What the uncontroverted evidence shows is that in order for that agreement to be enforceable, he had to have authority. At trial, Jeff Hooper, the executive director of the NCHA, and Don Bussey, who was the president at the time this occurred, both testified consistently. They did not authorize Goins to do anything other than what was in the written letter that Judge Gabriel referred to, Plaintiff's Exhibit 30. That's all.
Couldn't the jury just disbelieve that, too? Decide that they were lying about that? That they really did? I mean, how could they ever prove the opposite of that?
Well, there's a lot of ways, and I think that's what these cases go to, Justice Walker. I think the ways they could have disproved it, for example, were as if they had any communications with the NCHA saying, why aren't you enforcing our agreement? Here's the terms of it. Why aren't you doing that?
Did they have that communication with Mr. Zipper, I believe is the name, after Mr. Brewster came back from China?
That alleged conversation, Justice Gabriel, took place after the lawsuit was filed. Mr. Brewster, who was her then attorney, testified that when he returned from China, he had learned that a lawsuit had been filed and allegedly had a conversation with Hooper about what the terms of the agreement were. The record's clear on that. That's what his testimony says. The record's clear that neither Hooper nor Bussey nor anyone at the NCHA authorized, approved, agreed in any way to this alleged oral agreement, and never heard of it until after the lawsuit was filed.
Did Mr. Brewster testify that, in fact, Mr. Dolan told him that he had authority in the city to make the oral agreement that they alleged was made?
I don't believe that Mr. Brewster directly testified to that. I don't think there's any testimony that Mr. Goins said, I have authority to do this. I think he said they were in negotiations, and he knew that Goins was representing the NCHA. But that's the same thing that come up in all of these cases. Comes up in the Clear case, comes up in the Vadrine case, where it says mere employment of counsel does not clothe him with the authority to settle a case without specific authorization.
The problem here is that the six-month delay. You're saying, oh, well, she should have said, you're not complying with your agreement, but there was no way for her to know that the Cutting Horse Association wasn't going to comply with this agreement until 6 months elapsed. And so by that point, one side thinks the agreement's this, the other side apparently thinks the agreement's that, but there's no reason to be any dialogue between the two.
I think there is, Your Honor, because here's the scenario, and here's what the facts show, and this is, I think, pretty much undisputed, that she took the six-month suspension, that at the end of 6 months she came back and made repeated applications for reinstatement of non-professional status. In none of those applications is it ever said, we have an agreement that I'll come back in as a non-pro after 6 months. Never says that. She makes repeated applications in the fall of 2005, in the spring of 2006. She has all of these communications with the NCHA never once, and using three different lawyers, never once communicates to the NCHA that some other alleged oral agreement existed. So had she thought that an agreement existed, she certainly would have said, enforce my agreement now. The first time that agreement's mentioned is when this lawsuit gets filed. And so there was plenty of time for her to raise this. There were two separate hearings after the suspension ran out where the purpose of the hearing was, am I entitled to non-professional status? And at neither of those hearings, one was not an in-person hearing, it was done before the non-pro committee, in which Mr. Walker requested that they consider her application, no mention of an oral agreement for reinstatement. On August 20th, 2006, there was a separate hearing held before the entire executive committee. Mr. Walker submitted a brief. The court may recall part of that transcript was in the prior appeal as part of the summary judgment. In his brief, he mentions that this is the agreement, referring to Plaintiff's Exhibit 30. It's a 46-page brief, including attachments, and nothing is mentioned of any oral agreement. The specific purpose of that hearing was for that. That is a piece of evidence that was not admitted by the trial court, although the trial court, and that's part of our conditional cross-appeal, although the trial court allowed evidence of prior NCHA hearings in order for Mr. Walker to put his client's claim into context, he would not allow this to come in. And we offered it both in redacted forms to only reference the portions in which the oral agreement were discussed, or the settlement agreement, actually, since the oral agreement was not mentioned. And we also offered it in full form, their full side of the story, with no rebuttal from our part, because what it unequivocally says, and it's in the record, is we entered into a binding agreement in January of 2005 for these items, and no mention of any of that. So I think that Ms. Whitmire more than had the opportunity to bring this up before this lawsuit was never filed and failed to do so. I think under the cases that plaintiffs cite are interesting because they cite three cases. The Ebner case, the court found neither apparent nor actual authority. And so it supports our position that the evidence didn't support it. I mean, it goes against their position. The two cases that go for their position, Kettrick and West Beach, both have the same thing in common. A settlement agreement was made by a lawyer with his client sitting right here in mediation. Client sat there, listened to the agreement, didn't say no authority, didn't object. courts found in those cases it could be upheld because the client had full knowledge of what the lawyer did and sat on his hands and did nothing. Here, and again, we deny any agreement ever existed, but even arguendo if it did, that the testimony is uncontroverted that the NCHA had no idea of any of that until this lawsuit was filed. So the authority issue fails. The ratification issue, similarly, the evidence they point to for ratification is Mr. Brewster's discussion, alleged discussion, with Mr. Hooper. That occurred after the lawsuit was filed. That's not something that predated the lawsuit. So that's really irrelevant, and that's the only piece of evidence they point to for that. There's additional reasons why the JNOV was proper. For example, on the jury's award of damages, the evidence that plaintiffs put in at trial, certificates of ownership, there's three horses that they claim were devalued because this agreement was not honored. Ms. Whitmire couldn't ride as a non-pro, and they claim the horses went down in value because of that. There's three horses involved. They submitted certificates of ownership for two of them. One shows it's owned by Ray Whitmire. One shows it's owned by Whitmire Ranch, and there's no evidence in the record about who exactly owns the third horse that they're claiming damages on. The law is clear that she needs to show an ownership interest. This goes back to the Wagner case, Texas Supreme Court in 1905. A proprietary or ownership interest in the property that was devalued wasn't even shown.
Did she say she owned the horses?
She didn't say she owned the horses. There were some vague, references, I believe, in the record where it says they're asking their expert, with regard to appellant's horses, that kind of thing. But the evidence they put in shows Whitmire Ranch owns one, Ray Whitmire owns the other one, and that's what it shows. So she didn't even show an ownership interest in that, or what specific interest, if any, she owns in Whitmire Ranch. We also submit that the $70,000 awarded by the jury, which was properly disregarded by the trial court, that bore no relationship to any of the testimony that was entered. And finally, and this is part of also our conditional cross appeal, the only evidence of damages was testimony by their expert, Mr. Johnson. The sum total of Mr. Johnson's expertise and analysis for his opinion was, I asked Ray Whitmire what he paid for the horse, and I asked Ray Whitmire what he thought the horse was worth now, and that's my opinion as to the difference in value. Oh, and by the way, I asked the Whitmires, does Laney Whitmire ride that horse better than other people? And they said yes. Now, we had a Daubert hearing on that. That evidence should have never come in. It's the only evidence that's in the record on damages. There's no evidence from either of the plaintiffs. And there's just no damage, no proper damage testimony to show that the oral agreement claim could be sustained. Moving on to the false imprisonment claim, that's a pretty quick one. The jury entered a zero damage finding. The law is clear that on a zero damage finding, a take-nothing judgment is proper. That's what the court did, entered a take-nothing judgment. It does not say in the judgment it entered JNOV. It just says take-nothing on her claim for false imprisonment. Appellants did not file for a motion for new trial on that point. So the law is clear that if it's a $0 damage award, take-nothing judgment is proper. And if you want to assert any problem with the liability finding, you've got to file a motion for new trial. They didn't do that. So that point, I think, is pretty straightforward and clear. With regard to the NCHA's attorney's fees, they claim that we're not entitled to attorney's fees for several reasons, but I'm going to start with the fact that the evidence in the record is clear. Mr. Wehrman and myself submitted detailed affidavits stating what the amounts were, how they were broken down, how they were segregated. We submitted our attorney's fees statements. We described the amount of work that was attributable to the declaratory judgment claims versus the other non-attorney's fees claims and broke that down. So that evidence was sufficient. They point to other things which they claim should render us not entitled to receive attorney's fees. And one was that this prior appeal of this case in some way waived that issue because we didn't raise it along with the declaratory judgment claims. The attorney's fees which we were awarded were for declaratory judgment claims previously decided by this court. The cases that they cite talk about cases where a full and final judgment on the case was entered. In this case, the trial court, before it came up on the first appeal, entered a partial summary judgment and specifically reserved claims that on which judgment were not given for itself. And I read from the trial court's judgment in the first time around, NCHA's counterclaim, which included a counterclaim for declaratory judgment, attorney's fees, are hereby severed from this case and hereby abated pending further order from this court.
Your counterclaim, you asked for attorney's fees pursuant to your declaratory judgment.
We asked for attorney's fees under several grounds. We asked for attorney's fees under Rule 41 of the NCHA rules, which is a contractual rule entitling us to attorney's fees. And then we also asked for a declaratory judgment that no agreements have been breached, and we incorporated that into our attorney's fees paragraph as well. So it was pending and severed before that case came up to this court. So there's, we assert, no way that that could have been waived by not, there was nothing before this court about attorney's fees. There was no way for us to raise it.
Did
because
the
court...
Did the trial court grant a partial summary judgment against you on your attorney's fees?
No. There was a summary judgment. This is after the case went back down. The court granted a partial summary judgment on the attorney's fees claims under Rule 38, Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, and Rule 41 of the NCHA rules. That was an interlocutory order. The attorney's fees that were ultimately granted to the NCHA in this case were granted as a prevailing party under the Declaratory Judgment Act because they lost on their declaratory judgment claims. And the court had wide discretion to do that. Those claims were before it, and there was no abuse of discretion in doing that. As a matter of fact, the attorney's fees that Mr. Walker complains about were, I think, less than half of what was incurred, far less than half, even though the declaratory judgment claims comprised the bulk of this case. I see my time is up, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a few things to clarify very quickly on that attorney's fees issue. The judgment that was initially rendered that formed the basis for the first appeal said that, in fact, the claims were severed out. They were signed to their own cause number. With respect to Ray Whitmire's deck action, the breach of faults, breach of the oral contract, and the false imprisonment. The false imprisonment and the intentional infliction of emotional distress. But if you look at the specific order itself, it says on the page 6080 of volume 29 of 43, it says, as a result of the severance and redocketing of the severed claims, the judgment upon all claims concerning which summary judgment has been granted, which would be all the membership deck action claims Laney Whitmire had that formed a significant part of this court's first opinion, should be and is final. The court entered final judgment on those declaratory judgment claims. If you look at the final judgment entered in connection with this appeal, it says, it is ordered, adjudged, and decreed that plaintiff Laney Whitmire take nothing against the NCHA on her claims for breach of oral agreement, false imprisonment, exemplary damages, we sought a finding of malice in connection with the false imprisonment, and attorney's fees. This judgment did not address the membership claims with respect to Laney Whitmire's membership and the deck action because it was final. This court had already disposed of those claims on appeal. We petitioned to the Supreme Court to get that overturned, and it denied our petition. So they were not before the court, and the trial court had no plenary jurisdiction whatsoever to award attorney's fees with respect to those claims, as it just did, and that's a big part of our appeal. Now, with respect to that same issue, the counterclaim that's mentioned in the current judgment that we're appealing, he was simply incorrect. We had, Justice Walker, you're correct, secured summary judgment on that counterclaim. It was part of what had been severed out and abated. That counterclaim sought attorney's fees under Rule 41 of the NCHA internal rules and Section 38.001. When we came back down to the trial court, we moved for summary judgment on the grounds in part that, A, you can't interfere according to the court, this court's prior opinion, under the doctrine of judicial non-interference with respect to Rule 41, their internal rule. With respect to Section 38.001, the provision allowing for the recovery of attorney's fees for breach of a contract, they had no breach of contract claim. Now, with respect to the deck action fees that they sought against Ray Whitmire, because I think that it seems pretty clear in our briefing that the court simply lacked plenary jurisdiction to touch an attorney fee award on Laney Whitmire's declaratory judgment claims that were part of the prior appeal and disposed of, and that this court did not address in its mandate or remand for any purpose. with respect to the attorney's fee award against Ray Whitmire, the problem there is they didn't go to the jury on the fees. We didn't have an agreement to let them go to the bench. We objected when they went to the bench on their fees as to Ray Whitmire. They also didn't have the fee claim under the DEC Act pled. So it was a very difficult deal. You can seek fees under the DEC Act for defending a declaratory judgment action, but you have to plead it. They did not plead. So imagine the situation where we come back down to the trial court. They have two fee claims, one under Rule 41, one under Section 38001 for breach. We move for summary judgment. It's granted. They now have no fee claim pled in the entire case. And yet, and the DEC action that forms the basis for the fee claim as to Laney Whitmire's claims is not before the trial court, and it now lacks plenary jurisdiction to entertain it. The other fees, they never even went to the jury on, and we didn't agree that they could go to the bench on those fees. And we didn't think that they even thought they had a fee claim because it wasn't pled. We'd won summary judgment on the only fee claim they had. So,
in the Rule 11 agreement, when it mentions all parties' attorney fee evidence, you were thinking they're controverting experts? What's that supposed to refer to?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll be glad to address that. First of all, I sent an email to Mr. Werman saying, we would like to seek your consent to go to the bench on the plaintiff's attorney's fees. He said yes. I drafted the Rule 11 agreement that's in the record. And the first paragraph says, this will state our agreement with respect to the submission of the plaintiff's attorney's fees. And recall at that time, they didn't even have a claim pled, and the two claims they had when we came back down, we'd already won summary judgment on. So there were no fee claims to be made the subject of that letter. The last paragraph, in the middle paragraph, I say all parties will go to the bench, meaning as to my fee claim, the plaintiff's fee claim. Sir, that Mr. Morris did submit a controverting affidavit. I anticipated that. I understand. I wasn't suggesting that we would go to the bench on my fee claim and they wouldn't be allowed to provide any controverting evidence. It was a fair fight in that respect. The last paragraph of the letter, it's only a three-paragraph letter, says, if you sign this below, it signifies your client's agreement to the submission of the plaintiff's attorney's fee. That's all we were discussing. There was no claim before the court that they had pled seeking attorney's fees, and the only claim that they had defending a DEC action, they had lost power of.
Any other questions?
Yeah, sure. What is your response to his argument concerning the $70,000 in damages? Because you've got three horses here. The expert testified that the total damages was $130,000. The jury signed $70,000. There's no evidence that one horse belongs to what is your evidence to support that?
Yes, ma'am. I'm more than happy to respond to that. There was plenty of evidence to support that Laney Whitmire had an ownership interest in those horses at the time of the injury, which is the legal requirement. David Johnson, if you look at his testimony, that was our expert on the diminution in value of the horses during his direct examination, testified to a wide variety of factors and variables that he considered, the conformation of the horse, the appearance of the horse. He watched, I think, well over 100 videos of the three horses competing. He watched Laney competing on the horses. We showed portions of each one of those to the jury, and he commented on what he was seeing and why they were affecting his valuation at the time. He testified that, yes, in fact, he also interviewed Ray Whitmire. But they also overlooked the fact that Ray Whitmire testified to his substantial experience in putting a value on horses and buying and trading horses over a period of 30 to 40 years. And so there was more than ample evidence of all the various factors in his direct examination and through Mr. Whitmire's testimony. Mr. Whitmire testified to the fact that these were Laney's horses. He said, you know, we bought the horses. They were Laney's horses. The Whitmire Ranch owned the horses. There was evidence Laney, he said Laney owns the ranch. In fact, there was even a letter in the record from the NCHA that told her that she couldn't have those horses showing. She couldn't have any horses, I'm sorry, showing at an NCHA event as long as she had an ownership interest in them. And in fact, if the horses they were complaining about in that letter showed that the Whitmire Ranch had registered as the owner for the horses, and they said, well, since you own an interest in the Whitmire Ranch, those horses can't be shown. So you have to transfer them or divest, I guess, your ownership in the ranch. So there was ample evidence of that. The fact that our expert, on cross may have given up a point or two, that's the kind of balancing that the jury looks at, and that's what the trier of fact considered. And it weighed the credibility. They had an expert, too, who looked at the diminution of the value of horses, and he did admit that there was some diminution in value. He was just a little bit more rude about it and said it was because Laney was allowed to ride them. And he concluded the more she rode them, the worse they were going to get. I think it was reasonable to suggest the jury weighed those two experts' testimony and all the other testimony from Ray and Tommy Marvin, the trainer, that talked about Laney's horses. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you. I appreciate your argument.
Thank you.
The case is submitted, and this court will be adjourned.